Greetings and welcome back to The Brink. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson, recording the show on the evening of Friday, the 19th of June, 2020. I'm in central Tasmania. Looks like I'll be here about 3 more weeks before I just learned, to my great joy, that the border of the Northern Territory is going to open on the 17th of July. So that's my ticket to paradise. This show is entitled Celebrating a Cosmic Solstice. A cosmic window or convergence of multiple synchronicities. On the Brink, broadcast number 326. I'd really like to thank everybody for listening to and checking out my show about Dr. Rosalie Bertell. My very, very favorite hero of humans, second only to Rachel Carson herself. The blog post I was working on, it took me all week to get it done. It was just about as in-depth as my one I did back in December for the dealing with Australia under fire, the geophysical warfare, and the fire scenario here. But anyway, this weekend, this show, in the background you're listening to a very freaky kind of musical experiment. It's kind of a work in progress. It's mainly 3 different tracks from the soundtrack of the movie 2001, and 2 of them are composed by a Hungarian composer named Giorgi Ligeti. One of them is called Lux Aeternae, and the other one's called Atmospheres. And the third track is called Requiem in D minor or something like that. It was composed by somebody else. But so you've got all 3 of those layered together. You've got some sounds of radio galaxies colliding, recorded by Dr. Fiorella Terenzi, and you've got some songs of the humpback whale. So that's going behind us here. This is in honor of the cosmic background noise and the microwave radiation and everything that's there with us all the time, the cosmic energetic context that's made life possible here on Earth. That Vernadsky, the Russian scientist who I talked about a little bit in my last show, talked about the radiation hitting the Earth and that life is the most powerful geological force. Very, very, very interesting. This show is in honor of the cosmic convergence of celestial events happening even now and all through the next few days and weeks, focusing on the boreal winter solstice. That means in the southern hemisphere. Austral winter solstice. Boreal means in the northern hemisphere. So this is the austral winter solstice. I got that wrong in my blog post. How dare me. On Sunday morning, it's going to be the solstice. It's going to be the beginning of winter, the shortest day of the year in terms of light, although it will still be 24 hours long. And within a few hours of that, I believe 9 hours later, is the exact moment of the new moon, which is when the moon is in between the sun and the earth. And it's very hard to see at noon. But this new moon lines up in such a way as to create a total annular eclipse, whose path of totality will sort of arc across South Central Africa and Indonesia. An annular eclipse is distinguished from a total solar eclipse because annular occurs when the moon is further from the Earth and is therefore smaller in angular diameter than the sun. So even though it passes directly across the center of the sun, the size of the lunar disk is small, so it doesn't eclipse the disk of the sun totally, but almost, so it leaves a ring of light, a ring of fire around the edge, whereas a total solar eclipse occurs when the moon is closer and blots out the sun totally, so that you don't see any of the sun but just the corona. And there would be, you know, I'm really thinking of this for the first time. If you studied eclipses, every eclipse would probably occur with a different distance between the Earth and the sun, and a different distance between the Earth and the moon. So the angular size of the sun would change, as well as the angular size of the moon. Very, very interesting. It was interesting when I interviewed astronomer Duncan Steele back in Nelson in, I guess it was December or January. He was the comet astronomer who I had tried to get in touch with for 3 years, and finally lined up an interview, and we talked about comets and asteroids and stuff, and he gave me a copy of his book that's about eclipses. But the dark side was when he told me what he's doing now, working for this New Zealand-based company whose overt purpose is to process data from satellite imagery. And he told me that his project that he's writing a new book about, where he wanted to disseminate genetically modified organisms on Mars, which I thought was a joke until he told me in person, and then I realized what a horrible horror story that is. And I've nicknamed him Dr. Frankensteel. Anyway, when it comes to understanding eclipses and orbital mechanics and occultations and stuff like that, he's pretty much spot on. So we've got the annular eclipse that can only occur with the new moon, of course, within 9 hours of the solstice. The solstices are when the plane of the Earth's orbit, extending into space, crosses the orbit of the sun. And winter solstice is the shortest amount of daylight and the longest amount of night, and the summer solstice is the opposite. It changes from the longest day and starts shifting back towards the opposite direction. So this is actually contrary to what people in New Zealand and Australia say. They say that winter begins at the beginning of June, but it's not true. Astronomically, it begins on Sunday, usually the 21st, 22nd of June. Now, in addition to those cosmic things that are lining up almost within a few hours of each other, which is quite cosmic, we've also got a window of time called the heliacal rising of Venus. And heliacal comes from the word helios, that means the sun. I think it's Greek. Heliacal means rising with the sun. So Venus, I believe on the 14th or 15th, just a few days ago, Venus became visible in the morning again after being too close to the sun to be seen for X number of days, maybe a few weeks, because I remember seeing it as the evening star not that long ago. So the heliacal rising of Venus is a period of time which, according to my friend Mark Elmy, who's doing a lot of sort of work with the Mayan calendar, and not in the sense of Jose Arguelles, but with more sort of traditional three different language groups in Guatemala of actual Mayans, and he's living there, and he has a cool website called fourpillars.org, but he's doing what you might call Mayan astrology. And later on I'll talk about the difference between astronomy and astrology, but he was talking about some of the sort of beliefs or connotations of the heliacal rising of Venus, and that it's a pretty intense time, and that people of power don't want to rush into any major decisions during this window of time. So I'm not sure what exactly that means, but I know that this would be the kind of thing that it's a complex of long-standing associations in people's minds based on beliefs and how they've come to believe that. You know, when you see Venus becoming visible again in the morning after being invisible for a while. It could represent its rebirth, for example, and whoever Venus stands for, Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty, or something like that. Whereas, in terms of astrophysics, you could think of the energy of the Sun and Venus being together, like they're radiating at us from the same point, more or less. Not that Venus and the Sun are comparable, because really all the light from Venus is just the light of the Sun reflected from its gaseous cloud cover anyway. So that would be a negligible combination of energies, but symbolic nonetheless. So we're still in a window. I'm not sure when they say the heliacal rising of Venus will be over. I guess, you know, it just depends on how you want to define what close is to the Sun. So, also, starting a few days ago and going on now for the next, I don't know, weeks, we've got this beautiful little star cluster called the Pleiades, which in Japanese is called Subaru, and Maori it's called Matariki. That means either little eyes or the eyes of God. Matariki. Matariki is also a ceremony that the Maori of New Zealand have, sometime in late June, early to mid July. Kind of like a Christmas-like gathering or celebration. I remember I experienced one with some people in Kaitaia back in, that would have been 2003 with my friend Gina Robin and Gina Shepherd. So we've got the heliacal rising of the Pleiades now too. And so in fact, if you look at a little map, you'll see that the Moon and Venus is right there next to Aldebaran, the alpha brightest star in Taurus the Bull, and which is in this V-shaped formation called the Hyades. And then the Pleiades is the shoulder of the Bull. And so this is all coming up right now. So that's where the Moon is in Taurus. And that's very, very interesting. We've got Venus and the Moon in Taurus are right there. All this with the annular eclipse on the solstice. Now, also coming up, starting in about another 2 weeks or less, is a window of time, late June into early July, that I call the Encke window. That's E-N-C-K-E. And up until a few months ago, I was pronouncing it Inky, but my German friend, we saw the name on some kind of piece of gear on a sailboat with that same name, Encke, E-N-C-K-E. So she told me that that's how it's actually pronounced. Encke was the name of the astronomer who did not discover this comet, Encke, but first calculated its period, which is very short. It's one of the shortest returning comets that we have, reappearing about every 3.2 years. I've talked about this comet a lot on various shows and my communications with Bill Napier and Victor Klug, probably the top comet researchers on the whole planet. The significance of Comet Encke in the history of life on Earth as being originally a giant, what you might call a centaur, or a giant rogue comet that was huge, maybe 100 or more kilometers in diameter, its rocky ice core body. And through different kind of capture and gravitational perturbations and mechanisms and slingshot effects and everything, it or its fragments have impacted or collided with Earth probably numerous times. Some people believe that it might have even been Encke's original fully blown self that crashed into the Yucatan 65 million years ago to create the Chicxulub impact anomaly there, that many people believe is associated with the extinction sequence that took out the dinosaurs. So we've got Encke is, because it comes around a lot and there's a lot of debris and fragments out there, much of which is undetectable. This article from some Czechoslovakian Some Czech astronomers a few years ago talked about how they reckoned that there's some really large fragments, much bigger than we think, that are obscured by clouds of dust. So they're sort of indirectly indetectable. But they're still there and could be pulled into the loop somehow gravitationally. But we've got the, you know, I'm not going to go into the whole dynamic of comets and everything, but if we've got these sort of regions called the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt, these are kind of like these kind of disc shaped zones where that each one contains like probably billions or maybe even trillions of discrete objects, you know, maybe ranging from the size of, and it depends on how small down you want to go. That's what Duncan Steele was saying. If you want to count ones down to the size of a grain of sand, there would be, you know, more than there would be zeros for. But ones like that, I mean, if you look at it in terms of not just understanding what's there, but looking at what the effects or implications might be, if we had encounters with ones that are the size of sand, it's not really going to do too much, because if it did get captured by the Earth's gravity, it would just burn up in the atmosphere, and anything up to a certain size, you know, but maybe one 100 meters in diameter is probably going to make it to the surface before it burns totally up. So we don't really have any way of knowing, but apparently there's a lot of these objects out there, way more than we even believe. Like this guy that Bill Bryson quotes from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory says that if everyone had a little light on it, you could flip a switch and light it up, that you'd actually be terrified at how full the sky would be. Way, 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 way greater population of optical anomalies than Elon Musk can ever hope to achieve with his trains of SpaceX satellites up there with our 5G internet beaming down so we can get good sport on television. Help pay for Elon to go to Mars. He can bring, you know, he can actually bring Dr. Frankensteel's GMOs up there to disseminate. We'll give him something to do. Maybe have some greenhouses and plant some. So we've got the first of the two Anka windows, late June, early July, and the second one is late October, early November. And interestingly, the Tunguska explosion that leveled thousands of square kilometers of trees over Siberia in 1908 occurred on June 30th of that year within the Anka window. And I came up with the idea on my own that explosion might have been related to Anka because of the timing. Then when I was talking with Duncan Steele, he said that Arthur C. Clarke, the renowned science and science fiction writer with whom I spoke on the phone in 1996, had written an article or a letter to him, or expressed that same exact idea in a story or a book or something that he wrote. So we've got the Anka window from late June into early July. Then we've got another heliacal rising that occurs from about as early as the third week in July on into the middle of August. This is the heliacal rising of the star Sirius, the brightest star in the sky that we know of. It's Alpha Canis Majoris. And I see her shining very brightly as the first star that I usually see when I'm out at the river having played my flute to Mr. Platypus and do my Qigong as it's getting dark, and I look up and I look right at Sirius when I'm doing my Qigong. So, and then Orion is going down right below her. And so Sirius was very important. The heliacal rising of Sirius marked, Sirius apparently was worshipped as a deity by the ancient Egyptians, who thought that she represented Isis, who was Osiris's sister and consort, the goddess of life, as I understand it. And when Sirius comes out of being in conjunction with the sun for 70 days, which happens in late July, that represents the rebirth of Isis, the rebirth of life, the regeneration of life, and it's also the time when the the Nile River flooded, which was very important to the Egyptians for their agriculture and their survival and their well-being. And so the Heliacal Rising of Sirius depends on, you know, exactly all this stuff depends on the exact timing of it. It's going to depend on your, primarily your latitude and then your longitude in terms of the time factor. But it's all quite complex. But something that it was very interesting reading Duncan Steele's book on eclipses was about how all the different ancient cultures have been successfully able to predict eclipses. And it's pretty unimaginable when you try to think about what they would do. And part of it, he said, was kind of an empirical process where they would just kind of like keep meticulous records and look for patterns that repeated and stuff like that, and then sort of like extrapolate those patterns. But that told them kind of how and when it happened, but not exactly how or why, you know. But it was a very interesting book. So in honor of all the archaeos astronomy and the cetacean dreams time astronomy, which is a description of my intuition that the whales and dolphins have very, very advanced astronomical knowledge. Some of it overlaps with what we think we know, and a lot of it's completely in other kinds of different dimensions. But in honor of all this cosmic stuff happening and being here now in the what I consider to be the crown chakra of the rainbow serpent, depicted as a continental energy being of Australia, Tasmania is the head of the rainbow serpent, and therefore contains her crown chakra, which is the connection to the universe. So I consider that where I am right now in north central Tasmania is, I'm right on the crown chakra of the rainbow serpent. What a more powerful place to be during all this past 3 months, I just really can't imagine. So I've been working back on my art full-time the past couple of weeks, and got two or three more weeks to finish all this up before I head up to Darwin. And then I've been working on my most elaborate and complex medicine wheel, which is a Native American tradition of some stones lying in a circle on the ground, and it's used for ceremonial purposes, where I think that traditionally people would get inside it to dance and do ceremonies, play music and things like that. Well, the medicine wheels, Lisbon and I started out, we made our first medicine wheel on Flinders Island, and then we made several more around different places like in Darwin and in Manapouri, New Zealand, and Deloraine, Tasmania, and in Ballingup, Western Australia. And I made one in Gary Word and Halls Gap, Victoria, and a few other places. But then we made our eighth one. We rejuvenated our first one. This is when we went back to Flinders Island in 2011. And I started making a new one, and it evolved from just being one medicine wheel to become what I call our Mother Earth Temple, which was still the most largest, hugest, complex art project that I've ever done. It's kind of like an interdimensional park. It had seven medicine wheels, one with a jed pillar, a rainbow jed pillar at the crown chakra, over 1,000 rocks, 100 of them painted, a couple of metric tons of beautiful white sand, a kiva in the middle, a partially underground structure with a hexagonal roof filled with sand, and another medicine wheel of 28 lunar rocks on that. Oh, that just gives me another idea for my medicine wheel here. It might need a circle of 28 lunar rocks. Very interesting, and one with an eclipse. Anyway, I'm working on that here on my friend's property, and I've got the rocks that I'm working on now. They're big rocks from the north shore of Tasmania, and there's 13. And each one of them has a sacred landscape, dreamtime formation, like rocks or a mountain or something like that from Australia. Each one's got an animal or two, each one's got a plant or two, and each one's got an astronomical object configuration constellation. And so I'm working on all that right now, and we're actually going to Mount William National Park tomorrow, and we'll be there on Sunday for the solstice, and we'll climb Mount William, which is a very beautiful, it's not very high, it's only maybe a couple hundred meters high above the flat plain. You can look out and see Mount Monroe and the Strzelecki Peaks on Flinders Island, but it's just a beautiful, clear, enchanted, magical, peaceful, dreamtime embracement energy being there. It's going to be really, really nice. So I'll talk a little bit about the difference between astronomy and astrology. Astronomy is literally the study of the stars. And it's first we had naked eye astronomy, where people would look at the stars and they would name patterns of them. They'd name the stars and name. They'd say, like, well, this group of stars is the camel, or this group of stars is the hippopotamus, or this group of stars is the eagle, and that kind of thing. Frank Zappa made up his own one. It showed things like Hoover the vacuum cleaner and sort of modern day industrial archetypes for constellations. I thought that was quite funny. I think that's on an album called One Size Fits All. And then astronomy people, I mean, I'm guessing that the earliest astronomy was kind of like astronomy and astrology were sort of like kind of the same thing back in the day, because you wouldn't, probably the more ancient beliefs would be, they probably looked at these objects as gods or deities or beings. And then only with the worldview of science that came along with, like, Galileo and Copernicus, and maybe the Greeks, probably they defined them as points of light. And then it's really interesting. Bill Bryson did a good job of tracing the history of astronomy, sort of looking at the transition of human conceptions of what the stars actually are. But I think all along there's been a chain of belief or tradition in which the people never stopped looking at the stars as beings. Like Rudolf Steiner, for example, had a lot of stuff about that I don't really know all that much about. But, so, I mean, in the world of today, you could really, I don't really see a contradiction between looking at it both ways, going like, well, the stars are, the traditional science would say that they're nuclear reactors, but I think with the electric universe, that idea has changed a little bit more, but who knows? But this is just looking at a star as a physical, energetic, thermodynamic plasma, object that's doing all these energetic processes. That would be the same way of looking at a person and describing the person as a bunch of an assemblage of all these physiological and metabolical systems and tissues and organs and stuff, but you'd be missing the point of describing it as a person, or especially not just a person, a member of a certain species of life, but one with a name, with an individual identity based on a self-conscious awareness of who that is. And I guess Rudolf Steiner and maybe other people too have thought of the stars as being beings of this kind of nature, and why not? And of course, if the stars are going to be conscious beings, then the planets too would be, rather than just large sort of bodies of rock and gas orbiting the sun. They would have their own consciousness and psychological or spiritual or psychic attributes in addition to their gravitational and energetic presence. And so probably in the real world, we'll have to ask the whales and dolphins, because I think they know a lot more about this than we do. But in the real world, we've got all of this happening all the time. You've got, for example, from the sun, we've got the beautiful full-spectrum light and electromagnetic radiation that gives us warmth and all kinds of different energies and stuff that makes, like, life possible. But then you also talk about how if someone's your sunshine, it means that they're your bright, sunny day. They make you feel happy and joyful. And I truly am a sun worshiper. I love the sun. I call her Teowa, the Hopi name, because I just can't get enough of that beautiful golden sunshine energy absorbing into my body like a sponge. And I think it's more than just vitamin D. I just love. And it's not even just the warmth. It's just the beautiful. There's something about the energy of the sunlight that really charges me up on good energy. So astronomy is more looking at orbital mechanics and geometry and gravity and chemical systems and rotations and miniature solar systems and all this different kind of stuff. And it's primarily visual. It's what you can see. Whereas astrology is kind of like, it's kind of like the difference between looking at a person and you might perceive or photograph using curling and photography, for example. You might record or perceive someone's aura, the kind of glowing field of energy surrounding somebody that some people claim to be able to see. But it's kind of a physical thing based on bioenergetics and electromagnetism. So the difference between astronomy and astrology is kind of like looking at a person and whether you perceive their aura or their personality, their persona, their individual, unique beingness as their identity and qualitative attributes of who they are as a fellow being that you can communicate with or experience, feel a degree of empathy with. You know, so I think astrology is a lot more about the latter. And it's only part of what turned me off is it always seemed a bit like obsessed with predetermination in the sense of like, okay, if you're born on this day in this year, then blah, blah, blah is going to be here and blah, blah, blah is going to be there. And then you're going to be like this. You're going to have a tendency to do this and this and this and be this and this and this and not this and not this. And all that stuff, it just seemed way too cut and dried. And it seemed like people were, they weren't looking to see how you are. And then looking at your chart to see what that said, they were like, instead they were trying to tell you, they were trying to look at your chart and tell you that that's how you were, or that that's how you're supposed to be. It always seemed kind of backwards, which is why astrology always kind of, it never really interested me all that much. But certainly there's something to it. And that's where my friend Mark Elmy at fourpillars.org is doing some very interesting work with the much more traditional Mayans. Now, he's only working with three of the language groups out of maybe a couple of dozen that are there. And so to say that he's covering the Mayan cosmology perspective would be a bit of a reach, but he's definitely working with a significant part of it, because I mean, you don't know exactly how much they have in common and how much is everything is different. And it was kind of misleading for Jose Arguelles to claim he was representing the Mayans, because in a way he was, but in a way he really wasn't. You know, so it's all about the kind of generalizations and what we're all too willing to embrace as the simplified, easily manageable truth that's closer to the map rather than the actual extreme diversity and complexity of the actual territory that's so big and vast that our minds really don't have time or even the ability to grasp that level of reality. I'd like to honor a couple of Russian astronomers. Well, actually, one of them is not an astronomer. Emanuel Velikovsky, I've talked about many, many, many times. He was a psychoanalyst by profession, a student of Sigmund Freud, who became interested in the collective psychic components of humanity, how there seemed to be a lot of ancient stories about planetary-level catastrophic events. And so he started looking into that. But one of his interesting theories was that, and it was that Venus, the planet Venus, was originally a comet that got captured by Earth. And every astronomer I've ever talked to, they always bash on Velikovsky, and they'll never admit how big of an influence he was on them when they were young. you know, that might have even inspired them to start thinking in this kind of way. But in my reading of Bielakowski's books, especially Worlds in Collision, his first book, and Earth in Upheaval, his second book, in which he looks strictly at mainstream geological evidence for the Earth having been impacted many, many, many times. In my reading of his, like Venus's Comet theory, the way he's writing, it's not a scientifically peer-reviewed article that he's writing, and I don't think that he's trying to say that, look, this is, I know this is exactly how it was, this is what happened, and this is how it is, and blah, blah, blah. I don't think he ever, I don't think he was writing in that kind of tone or on a soapbox like that or anything like that. That's how these astronomers react or respond to him. They go like, oh, that's outrageous bullshit. Nobody could believe that, blah, blah, blah. And I go, well, look, were you there? Who of us that are alive now were there to witness any of this stuff or even able to speak the languages that existed back then that these descriptions are actually written in? You know, it's amazing that we can trick ourselves into believing that we remember as much as we do. And that's where I think one of the key things with the whales and dolphins is that the way that they remember things is really different. It's organized in a very different way, at a much higher level of coherence than ours. And that they're willing and able to remember. I mean, it's maybe even a difference between, like, we don't think of recording as a form of memory, yet it really is. It's like using an external technology to help us remember. But the difference between a photograph or a movie of something and our memory is that the photograph, within certain limits, shows what was really there. I mean, it shows what the lens focused on and saw. Whereas our mind might selectively alter these images that are in our mind. And so this is a very interesting thing, but to think back on what our ancient ancestors might have witnessed in the sky, or with things like planets being in different places from where they are now, and electrical discharges happening between the planets, and many more comets frequenting the skies, which is, a lot of people think that this is how it was like in the skies of the Earth, not all that long ago, maybe just, you know, 1,000 years ago. But that the whole idea that Venus was captured, it's not impossible. It's not impossible. You know, so the critics of Bielakowski scold him for daring to make these outrageous proclamations, but I don't think he wrote it that way. I think he was offering it as imaginative speculation in the spirit of Einstein, who said, Einstein was one of his closest friends in recent years, in the last years of Einstein's life. And Einstein said, imagination is more powerful or more important than knowledge. And I really agree. I really agree with that. And so I think that that's the spirit in which Bielakowski offered a lot of these theories and stuff. He wasn't trying to say this is the absolute way that it was here. Put my article in these science journals and let me be the peer-reviewed academic authority on all this stuff. He wasn't coming at it from that direction. And so that's why that, and that he was touching on a lot of these kind of memories that are repressed in people as a whole. And some people are actually scared when you start talking about the Earth having been impacted and life brought to its knees and almost completely exterminated, probably countless times in the history of life on the Earth. Anyway, I really honor Immanuel Bielakowski. There's a Russian astrophysicist or radio astronomer named Yusuf Shklovsky. That's S-C-H-K-L-O-V-S-K-Y. And he wrote or co-authored or wrote a book that Carl Sagan edited called Intelligent Life in the Universe from 1966. And I remember seeing this book when I was in like sixth or seventh grade. And I checked it out, and it was over my head at the time, but this was very far-out stuff. And to me, as much as I really respect Carl Sagan, not only as an astronomical educator, but also as a nuclear awareness activist, he was one of the people that most grievously attacked Emanuel Velikovsky, like, did his best to stop his books from getting published. And, you know, but it's funny because, and he's talking about Velikovsky when he's talking about pseudoscience or junk science, you know, and stuff like that. But it's funny that in just looking at Shklovsky's book, Intelligent Life in the Universe, in the first chapter, they're talking about, oh, what are UFOs? You know, they've actually been sighted, blah, blah, blah. And so just the fact that Carl Sagan is accepting the existence of UFOs, whatever they are, that he's talking about that. Yet, for Emanuel Velikovsky to describe Venus as possibly having been a comet, I mean, which is the more further out in true honesty? You know, that's actually a very good question. So anyway, I better sign off for now. I've got to edit this show and upload it for Jules Stanley, who's managed to hang in there without freaking out with her daughter there up in New York during all this craziness. And now, simultaneously with borders opening in Australia, New Zealand's now nailed boards to their border by this unbelievable, ludicrous story of these women that escaped from quarantine, and one of them came down with the CV, and they might have spread it to 300 people, and they're doing all their contact tracing. And so now, because of this, now the New Zealand military finally has something to do. All that money that Lockheed's paying them is now going to be used on, they're going to manage the quarantine process at New Zealand's borders. And I go, well, look, it's about time that New Zealand's military actually had something to do, because decades ago they were talking about how, oh, well, you know, New Zealand's such a desired destination for people to visit and come and live, and all the rest of the world's turning to shit. And so now the whole fucking world's going to want to move to New Zealand. We're going to have to block off our borders to keep them out. Well, it's come to pass, but not quite in that kind of way. So if New Zealand's going to be so stupid as to completely drive a stake through its extraordinarily awesome, economically, tourism industry, that I think as a money-making endeavor in New Zealand, it was second only to the fishing industry. I believe that's right. It was up there. It would be probably in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year for New Zealand. So that they're going to shut themselves off from that, that is truly economic warfare. It's got nothing to do with virology, epidemiology, any kind of biomedical health or issue or scenario or anomaly. Man. Not that I believe coronavirus is a discrete autonomous pathogen anyway. It's a media artifact more than anything else. But for them to do this based on that is just unbelievable. And so, you know, like, I don't know where it's all going to go, but I wake up every day and I just give thanks for being here now and to have had this beautiful time in Tasmania and Australia that I know and love so well, and to play my flute with Mr. Platypus almost every evening, and to be able to go to beautiful Mount William tomorrow and go swim in the ocean and ride my bike and hopefully make it out to Three Hummock Island in the spirit of my brother Rob Alliston, and maybe the Flinders Island and the Great Ocean Road, catch up with the Gadubinud people and see where Coolasuchus came from, and go to Kata, Victor Harbor, Central Desert, Uluru, Katachuta, Attila, Litchfield, Nikmaluk, Kakadu, and Darwin in the top end, and down through Western Australia, Purnalulu, and Karajini, and the Guion Rock Art. Oh my God, and I want to visit those rockart sites that have just been slated to get blown up by Rio Tinto. We've got to do some healing out there. And my healing journey is in honor of all the critters, the life forms. Apparently there's 119 that are on the critically endangered list. Maybe an upcoming show will be in their honor too. Because, you know, there was apparently a 7.4 earthquake in the Kermadec Trench area today that would have been felt all through all of New Zealand. And it's really made me think about the technotronic warfare that Rosalie Bertel and Nick Begich have told us about, and the fact that all the weird weather and stuff, the prolonged, record-breaking, unprecedented drought conditions on the North Island of New Zealand now, it's environmental warfare. And looking at once the warm weather starts coming back, I mean, last year we had fires starting in Australia as early as even in September. That's not that far away. That's only 3 months from now. And so I just, you know, this is going to really be a spring and summer to watch out for in terms of environmental warfare. Anyway, I'm so glad to be here on Mother Earth and to be able to breathe beautiful air and absorb beautiful sunshine and drink pure water. And I've got more phytochemicals in my body than in my whole life, and making my medicine wheel and doing all my paintings and getting ready to do some traveling again and be the human RNA messenger molecule. Anyway, it's a very cosmic weekend. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off for On the Brink Radio. And get ready for some cosmic energy. Good day.